Ladies and gentlemen, tonight we are making recordings of the proceedings, and these recordings are to be placed in an iron box and buried in the ground and dug up 25 years hence so that we can see whether we have suffered any vocal changes or any changes of diction during the 25-year period. So I'm talking now just so they can get a recording level back there on the machine. Is everything okay, Mr. Engineer? Now the history of this association is known to some of you, and perhaps some of you know it better than I. But I would like to give something of the early history of the association as I saw it. And the history begins way back when the Dutch landed on the coast of the United States of America, which was not then United States of America, as you well know. And they were looking for some desirable land, and they fancied a certain island lying off the eastern coast of the United States, and they called it Manhattan. And they looked around for someone to sell them the island, and they found an Indian living on Long Island in a place that is now Brooklyn, ironically enough, and he sold them the rights to settle in Manhattan. It was discovered later that this Brooklyn Indian had no right to sell the land. He didn't own it, but the Dutch had paid for it, and so they kept possession of it. Now, that's the beginning of the association. Now, we skip over a few years, and we come to Dr. Lee Travis's living room in Iowa City. At that time, Lee and I sat down. There were several graduate students sitting around, and we talked about an organization. It seemed desirable that we should get together and make our work in speech correction a little more eclectic. There were too many discipleships that were in conflict. We wanted to get together and share our lore and develop profession that was dignified with knowledge that was negotiable. So we did a lot of dreaming that night, and the plans were drawn. Then the scene changes again to a hotel in this island of Manhattan that the Dutch bought from a crooked Indian in Brooklyn. And in that island in Manhattan, the association was born. Now, the idea in those days was that we wanted an exclusive organization. We wanted an organization of apart from the National Association of Teachers of Speech. We felt the need of liberty, freedom, and a separation from the cruel masters that were controlling our destinies. So we drew up the Magna Carta, and things went along pretty well with that Magna Carta. And then the idea occurred to some of us, why not invite a few people? Of course, we couldn't take them into the inner circle, but we could invite them to meet with us and share the good things of our conventions. And so we invited those people. After a while, those people got ideas of their own about wanting the right to vote. They thought this Magna Carta that we had drawn up for the nobles was for the common people too. And so they insisted that they be taken into membership. And so they were allowed to come into membership. And it's good you like the history of the Parliament of England. The nobles used to run things, the House of Lords. But gradually, the House of Commons got more and more power, until after a while, the House of Lords is just a sort of a gentleman's club filled with stuffy old fellows that don't have any power, but wear nice clothes and put on quite a show. So the fellows that originally made up the organization find themselves crowded into the House of Lords, and the work of the association is now being done by people that Lee and I never contemplated would have anything to do with it at all. So I'm thinking of proposing to Lee that we organize a group of fellows and keep the rascals out. That's the only way we can achieve any dignity now. The camel has come into the tent and kicked out the master. We've got to have a new tent. Well, so the association was born 25 years ago in this hotel in Manhattan. Now, the first administration was an administration in which things moved very fast. After all, it's about like the development of a child. Things happen very fast in the first 2 or 3 years of life, and then they gradually slow up. And so you will see from these dated cards along here that the early administrations took in a good deal of territory, and then gradually we slowed up these administrations, and we went a year at a time. The first administration following mine was that of Dr. Elmer Kenyon. Now, the highlights, I think, as I remember it, of his administration, and I must speak for him since he cannot speak for himself, were two. One, that he called together a meeting that he called the Symposium on Stuttering. We had a great many divergent views on stuttering in those days. And it seemed to him desirable that we get together and talk things out, and it may be that we could come to some agreement. So we had a very remarkable symposium on stuttering, and I saw a copy of that symposium the other day. That was his attempt to make this work eclectic, which I think was a forward-looking enterprise at that early date. Another highlight of his administration was that he believed we ought to have standards of competence, standards of training, so that the Committee on Education was established at that time. And that committee has gone on ever since until it is one of the most useful and most powerful committees of the organization. And so, those two things, I think, we can give credit to Elmer Kenyon. Now, since he isn't here, and since the Ohio Association of Speech Therapists have furnished these flowers in very beautiful tribute to these two gentlemen who have gone on and whom we honor tonight, I would like to have you all stand right now in memory of Dr. Elmer Kenyon. Let me say, here's to the memory of Elmer Kenyon, doctor of medicine, specialist in otolaryngology, a splendid gentleman of the old school, of quiet dignity, personal honor, and professional idealism. Thank you. Now a child changes very rapidly in the first few years of his life, and so this organization changed very rapidly in its first few years of life. It would be hard to recognize the child of 8 if you had known the child of 4. And we came next to the administration of Dr. Smiley Blanton. I talked with Dr. Smiley Blanton at his home in New York the other day and asked him if he was coming to this meeting. He assured me that he wanted to come and intended to come, but he has been prevented from coming. And he said, yes, those dear old days, I wish we could revive them again. I remember Dr. Smiley Blanton for the fact that he was my teacher. That's an important thing. Another thing about Smiley Blanton that we should comment on at this time is that he organized the first college speech clinic in the country. And another important thing is that he gave the first Ph.D. in speech in the history of the world, and the first Ph.D. in speech in the history of the world was earned by the only lady on the platform, and I'll let her speak for herself when her administration comes around. I remember one incident in Smiley Blanton's teaching that is rather significant. You see, Elmer Kenyon believed that the way to teach speech was to teach speech. The way to get a person over his stuttering was to show him how to talk. It was silly to think of anything else, to show him how to make the vocal cords open and close, how to form the sounds of the lips, and to begin right down at the beginning of things and teach a stutterer all over again the business of talking. But along came Smiley Blanton, who said, oh no, that's just the wrong thing to do. You make him too conscious of his speech. The thing to do is mental hygiene. So his courses in speech correction were largely courses in mental hygiene. And they were widely elected by people in psychology and in sociology, people who weren't primarily interested in speech correction. And yet, of course, a great many speech correctionists were trained by Dr. Smiley Blanton. He used to conduct demonstrations at the State Hospital for the Insane for his classes. And I remember one morning we were gathered together in the hospital classroom. He had interviewed a woman the night before who was very, very manic, and he wanted to show us what a manic looked like and talked like and acted like. So we brought her in before the class, and he found that she was in a depressed mood the next morning. She would say nothing whatsoever. She just came in and looked glum and didn't react at all. He was a little disappointed and saw that the game was up, put his arm on her shoulder and said, well, I think that'll be all, Mrs. Smith. You may go now. And she looked at him and she said, take your arm off my shoulder. Then he saw that he was breaking through the crust, and it may be that he could get her going as a good demonstration after all. So he hugged her a little tighter, and he said, why should I take my arm off your shoulder? And she looked him straight in the eye, and she said, the men that God made have hair on their heads. So you see the things that we remember about our teachers. But at least it illustrated the sort of thing that Dr. Smiley Blanton did. Now I want to read the telegram that he has sent us. Deeper regret that illness prevents me from being with you this evening. The happiest memories of my life and the hour are the hours that I had meeting with the speech group and working in this field. I send you all my affectionate regards and best wishes for an even more successful future. Smiley Blanton, New York. And after Smiley Blanton, we come to the administration of Dr. Lee Edward Travis. And Dr. Travis, will you come to the podium? We will take just a very few minutes of your time to pass over this very insignificant administration. By this time, the society had settled down to late infancy. Speech had been acquired. There was no stuttering indicated. Articulation was intelligible. Voice quality was a little uncertain as to whether this was going to be a male or a female. And I suspect that some of the later presidents may remark upon that uncertainty yet. It's one of the few societies in this area that seems to be at least fair as far as the weaker of the two sexes is concerned, namely the male sex. Most other societies seem to have found the right proportion of getting the stronger sex in there. But so far, we men have done fairly well here. Now, I received a letter from Henry Moser, as did these other presidents, telling us about this situation here tonight. That was really something. The gist of it was this. Dr. Kenyon is dead, and his voice is gone forever. Dr. Goldstein is dead, and his voice is gone forever. Send a recording of your voice immediately. I sat down, wrote him a letter that I wasn't dead, and I didn't intend to die, my voice wasn't gone, I didn't think it would be gone, and that what little I had to say could be said at the meeting, and that I was sure that I would be in adequate voice. So, I would like to just record a little bit more. That's all this is for, just to get a recording to bury in the ground, as Bob has said, and dig out someday. As far as I know, there's no other point to trying to tell you anything about what past presidents did. I mean, that's a little ridiculous. But the implication all through here is strong, if not the facts.
I walked in as late as possible to the meeting tonight, and the first thing that struck me was I looked up on at this table, and those numbers are very small over there to your left. And they get bigger and bigger down here. And the implication of this letter from Moser and the facts of these figures are certainly indicative of the relatively rapid passage of a relatively long period of time. But with certain people, particularly, there seems to be some discrepancy between chronological age and physiological age. For example, the man on my right, my immediate right, is really so young that it would take a careful examination to see the hairs of the infant sprouting there. Whereas the man on my left, you can see that he's older, his hair is more abundant, and it's practically enough there to curl the comb. Now, Dr. Sarah has really become so young that she's just built a new home in a very wild section of wild Los Angeles, out there among the pine trees, in a very modern setting. And I could go on, but I'd just like to end this little recording by saying, somewhat repeating what I said this afternoon, that our last president, this man with this hair, has really grown so old, as I told you this afternoon, that he's practically quit stuttering. So I think that in certain respects that these presidents have sort of reversed the situation, that the old boys are now the young boys, and the young boys, the recent boys, are in some respects the old boys. I certainly would like to close in wishing this onrushing generation, Bob, of Commons, the best of luck, and that as the going may get extremely tough, they might call upon some of us for just a word of advice, if not consolation.
Thank you, Dr. Lee Travis. The next administration was that of Dr. Goldstein of the Central Institute, St. Louis. Now, we have a recording of his voice. You will remember, some of you, the occasion upon which that recording was done. He demonstrated for us a very thrilling case of a man the major portion of whose tongue had been removed and who still was able to make articulatory adjustments without that musculature that had been taken off. And so he made a recording, he brought it to the convention, and we listen to it. But before we listen to that recording, I'd like to say something about Dr. Goldstein. He identified himself so closely with the Central Institute for the Deaf that one couldn't tell whether he was talking for Max Goldstein or for the Central Institute. They were one and the same thing. But when he became president of the Association, he extended that energetic loyalty to the Association, and we had a very effective administration in that period. That, I think, was the beginning of this audiology movement. It was the beginning of what may have been, if it hadn't been for the wise administration of this president and the president who preceded him a place where we might have had a split in the organization. Dr. Goldstein saw that speech was not just producing sounds, but speech was also the receiving of sounds, that there were two angles to the game of speech. And he wanted to bring into prominence, bring into some focus, the receptive aspects of speech correction. Another thing that Dr. Goldstein was very much interested in also was that of voice. Voice, problems of the larynx, problems of adjustment and compensation for operations in the larynx, and hearing were the things that he stands for in my mind. Now shall we hear the voice of Dr. Goldstein.
For over a century, the tongue has been considered as the most indispensable organ in the production of human speech, and its changing positions in the oral cavity for the enunciation of consonant elements has been classically considered and taught in all literature of speech and phonetics. In the light of modern acoustic principles and mechanics of speech, it is possible that much of this information concerning the physiological functions of the tongue may have been developed with too much empiricism. This has been brought home to us most vividly in a series of recent clinical cases recorded and analyzed in the sound laboratories of Central Institute for the Deaf. A most effective example to illustrate our exaggeration of the importance of tongue position in the production of consonant elements of speech is offered in the phonograph record now presented of a case of total amputation of the tongue. The patient, Clarence C. M. Finn, 57 years of age, a plumber by trade and a resident of St. Louis County, was operated in July 1931 by Dr. James Barrett Brown of St. Louis. The operation was imperative and consisted of complete extirpation of the tongue for cancer. The tongue was amputated flush with a cornu of the hyoid bone, and not a vestige of tongue tissue remained. This patient made an uneventful recovery, has had no recurrence of this pathology in over 7 years, and his rehabilitated speech is self-taught and was acquired within a few weeks after the healing of the operated field. Before commenting further on this unusual speech rehabilitation, I will ask Mr. Finn a few questions to indicate his facility in daily conversation. What is your name?
Clarence Cornelius Michael Finn.
Where do you live?
I live at 201 East Ever Avenue, St. Louis County.
How old are you?
I am 57 years of age.
What is your occupation?
I am a plumber.
How long have you been engaged in this work?
For 40 years.
Have you found the absence of your tongue a special handicap in carrying on your trade?
I have no trouble in getting those with whom I come in contact to understand everything I say.
Did you receive any medical treatment for this pathology of the tongue before you consulted your surgeon?
I was treated by a doctor with a so-called cancer test. And the pain was just something terrible.
How soon after the amputation of your tongue did you find it possible to make yourself understood by speech?
Almost immediately.
Do you use the telephone in your business?
Every day, just like anyone else uses it.
And the people have no difficulty in understanding you over the phone?
None whatever.
Now, Mr. Finn, I should like you to illustrate with your own voice and speech what facility and accuracy you have in fluent speech. For this purpose, we have arranged a series of sentences in which initial and final consonants are used that have always been considered impossible without the tongue assuming certain positions in the mouth cavity. These consonant elements are offered to convince the listener of the ease, quality, and distinctness of your speech. Please read the sentences that have been prepared to illustrate the individual consonant elements. The first consonant I will ask you to illustrate is T.
The first T. The two tall travelers told the tale to Thomas. Ten and ten and two are 22.
Next is L.
L. Longfellow loves little children. Luke lost his luggage in the lake.
Then comes K.
K. The hook cut the coconut cake into quarters. The cat climbed the tree and popped the canary.
Now the letter M.
M. 99 names were nailed to the sign. No one knew the names of the 9 new Navy cruisers.
Now the letter D.
D. Dan and David went on a daring adventure. Don't deny yourself the delight of your daily dozen.
Then follows G.
G. Are you giving grandmother a Christmas gift?
Finally, a sentence that contains all of the above consonant elements.
Good gracious. Did I take the candy from little Nellie.
This demonstration offers practical evidence of ability to produce understandable speech involving the speech elements which heretofore were thought impossible without the aid of certain positions of the tongue in the mouth cavity. For T, we have always taught that the tip of the tongue must touch the posterior surface of the upper incisor teeth. For K, the middle third of the tongue is arched so that it approximates the arch of the palate above. For L, the tip of the tongue is raised and the anterior third of the tongue partly depressed in the floor of the mouth. For D, a similar position to that used for T is assumed. M has a similar position but includes a different placement of the vocal element as it reaches the nasal resonating cavity. Added to this tremendous handicap, this patient has but 3 remaining teeth, and much of the alveolar process of the jaw has been absorbed, as is frequently found in the aged. Another interesting observation in this case is Mr. Finn's own report about his sense of taste. Tell us about this, Mr. Finn.
Well, there are a good many good things to eat that we all like to eat. And if I didn't have a sense of taste, almost anything would be all right. But I like a lot of different good things to eat. And I am always well satisfied.
Finally, the lower branches of the facial nerve, supplying the left upper and lower lips, were cut during the operation. Yet with the absence of these three important factors in the production of speech, this gentleman has given an excellent account of himself in the quality, distinctness, inflection, and volume of spoken language. Here is a real problem for research and perhaps reconstruction of our knowledge of speech physiology as it concerns the tongue.
Now, now may we rise again, please. Here's to the memory of Dr. Max Goldstein, researcher, author, editor, administrator, and humanitarian. Thank you. Now, by this time, the child had become 14 years of age, had reached puberty, and we came to the administration of Dr. Sarah Stinchfield. So we began to wonder if perhaps the child was not female in sex. Now, Dr. Stinchfield, will you come to the podium?
Thank you. I'm overwhelmed for the second or third time today. While our first president was talking, I was thinking of that first meeting in New York, 1925, I believe it was. I was reminded of a story of the young couple who were talking about their courtship days when their young son spoke up and said, "Daddy, where was I then?" And if I weren't older than Robert, I should say, "Where was I then, Robert?" Because my job at that time was to help collect the group who were really interested in speech correction, and we only succeeded in finding about a dozen people at that time who were really doing something which we then called speech correction. We've come a long way since then. If I had time, I'd like to televise a little bit. And I think our next step, for our next convention, we will do a television set, perhaps. I wish we might do it now. I understand Dr. Travis and some of the others have already done it. I would call it milestones, I think. And I would say that since I was supposed to show a sense of humor, I usually depend on my husband for that, but he isn't here. It just happens that I had my first teaching in a private school up in New England, and I had assigned as teacher of speech on the artistic side, just out of the School of Expression, a poem from a standard author, and a big burly football hero arose in my class and said, "That teacher was the worst I ever tackled. She once so very tall and she was light. It's best to lay our eggs before we cackle, but we surely never thought that she would fight." So then I kept him there for about 15 minutes, doing that with every possible variation. And then the class began to laugh with me, and the boy began to wilt. And maybe that explains why I didn't have any more disciplinary problem in that school. That was my first milestone. Then the next, I think, was the summer in Pittsburgh playgrounds when we were doing educational dramatics. And at that time, we were improvising the play of the Four Seasons. And just as Mother Ceres made a remark, the distinguished superintendent of schools, Dr. Davidson, the head of the 22 playgrounds, and several distinguished visitors from out of town walked in on this cue, Mother Ceres. "Where, oh, where is my daughter Persephone?" And a boy rose up and said, "Pluto has taken her to the underworld." I expected to lose my job over that improvisation, but it happened that the guests merely smiled and teacher blushed, and then at that point decided that she must go into speech correction. After that, the next milestone, I think, was in the summer of 1917, when on a scholarship, Frick scholarship from the Pittsburgh schools, teacher went to New York and was there during the thrilling days watching the salute to the flag each night and hearing about our saving the world for democracy. It was a thrilling time. We were all extremely excited, patriotic. And I went back to Pittsburgh only to stay there a short time. Then I went to the University of Iowa. It's thrilling to think of the teachers that we had there, our Dean Seashore, our Dr. Bird Baldwin, who since died, both of those men are gone now, Dr. Lee Wallace Dean, Dr. Samuel Orton. They were great teachers, great leaders, and I would like to pay my tribute to those men at this time. Then after a little time there where we started with palatal cases at the university hospital and had about 60 children a year, and teacher had no assistant at that time, we went to the next milestone was the University of Wisconsin, where for 2 years I worked under the supervision of Dr. Blanton, and where my co-workers were Drs. West and Dr. Weaver. There we had a very interesting setup, which terminated by my leaving the Middle West to go to New England. And so I seem to have migrated from the East to the West, back to the West, and then to go away across country. So the next milestone would represent work in the far West on the Pacific Coast. We've had some very interesting developments there. We've seen the work develop. We've seen credentials. The requirements for credentials increased by leaps and bounds. We've seen the various speech societies spring up and grow. We've seen the work of Miss Chapin in the Los Angeles schools over a long period of years, and now her successor, Miss Kessler, who is with you tonight. Dr. Travis' work in the clinic at USC has increased so that he's had to have about 5 new buildings, I believe, to house his men and his women. We've been working with Graves. That's off the record. And, we have grown there since the war in an astonishing fashion. The work of Mr. Schultz, which was shown you last night on the film, shows you what has been done in the field of aphasia. The work of Dr. Nielsen is simply uncanny in the aphasia field out there. We've all been very glad that he gave us a course one summer on that in that field. The work has advanced in so many places, in so many ways, that it's difficult to realize what has happened. It's almost like Genie had suddenly waved a magic wand and had transformed the whole face of our work. So that I think we all, every one of us here tonight, get a tremendous thrill out of seeing each and every one of you here. And we're tremendously pleased to think this society has grown until the tail almost wags the dog, the NATS, and I think now we will eventually be on our own, I hope, and we will be televising, we will be instructing by television, is my forecast. And our men who did such distinguished service during the war, our younger men, Dr. Kep Baker, many of our men, Dr. Travis, so many of our younger men here at this table and at your tables were in service, that I think we owe a tribute to them as well as to our older instructors. And I'd like to close with the words of Tiny Tim. God bless you, everyone.
apparently Dr. Stinchfield was too humble when she said she didn't have a sense of humor. I remember Dr. Stinchfield when she was at Wisconsin. She had a home, a room across the bay of Lake Mendota. And she, even though she was a poor graduate assistant, I mean poor in money, she did have two outfits of fig leaves. And she kept one in the office and one in her room. And she would swim across the bay and take off her swimming suit and put on her work clothes, and then when the work of the day was over, put on a swimming suit and swim back across to her room. Very athletic girl in those days. We come next to the administration of one of the most active of all of the original organizers of the association, Dr. Samuel Robbins.
When I received that very cordial invitation from the chairman of the program committee to attend this banquet, I couldn't help thinking of the difference between his cordiality and that accorded to a classmate of Mrs. Robbins. It seems that Professor St. John of the University of Hawaii was invited to address a certain group of young men in Jesus College over in England. And in the conversation the correspondence which followed, they wrote very particularly and asked Professor St. John, "Have you a dress suit?" And he replied, "Yes, I have a dress suit, and I will take it with me and wear it. And my wife, St. John, will accompany me." In due time, an answer came back. "We are glad to welcome Mrs. St. John, of course, but you understand that you will be staying in the dormitory and she'll be with a private family 4 miles out. And, of course, you'll be eating in the commons, but she will be eating with the private family 4 miles out. And, of course, the meeting is open to young men only, but there's a balcony upstairs and a screen of the balcony, and Mrs. St. John may hide behind the screen and listen to your paper and enjoy it up there." He wrote back that Mrs. St. John had changed her plan because she felt that they wanted the dress suit more than they wanted her, and that she would not accompany him as she had planned on the trip to England. But he assured them again, "Yes, I have a dress suit and I will wear it on that occasion." All seemed to be settled very nicely. When they went down to the boat to sail for England, there was a cablegram, "St. John, have you a dress suit? Signed, Jesus." I've been asked to tell you some of the little-known facts of humor that occurred during the administration of Mr. President. The first act of my office is known, I think, to 4 people. One of whom was 9/10 asleep. 2, I think, would not have told the story on themselves. And I have been, perhaps we might say, discreet. We were having our convention that year at Pennsylvania State College. And we were guests of the college and roomed in one of their delightful dormitories. Dr. Russell and I roomed together as our custom was. We'd been coining terms. We got some good long ones that night, until about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. We just retired and gotten to sleep and mixed up with dreams, and otherwise I heard this tremendous scream out in the corridor and this rap at my door. And I get up, threw on an overcoat, got my flashlight, went out the corridor, and there were 2 young ladies who found a mouse in their room. The mouse had got in the wastebasket, and they got the wastebasket out in the corridor. They didn't know what to do next. Well, I suggested perhaps that they went back in their room and closed the door. The mouse wouldn't follow them back. There was a nice fire door there. I inspected it carefully for any sprinklers or fire alarms that might set off, and I decided it was safe to open the door and I presume the mouse is still out there. I didn't stop to investigate. At least we get rid of that mouse. I was a war president, and the first thing I wished to do was to get this new society that wasn't very well known in those days on the map, as recognized as useful in doing their share in military service, we might say. They were getting up what they called at that time the National Roster of Scientific Personnel. My wife once caught me saying the National Rooster. My mistake. Be careful not to use that term tonight. Well, I happened to know Dr. Carmichael, who was the chairman of that, and I arranged with him that a committee from our organization would draw up a suitable questionnaire, which after many audits and one helping out the other, got through. And most of you received it who were at that time members. At the next convention, I was talking this over with those who drew it up, and Dr. West came into the middle of the conversation, overheard what we were saying. He said, you know, that's a pretty damn good questionnaire. I didn't know the United States military service had anybody who knew as much about speech therapy as that. Many of you don't know that I was one of your first vice presidents. I was vice president under your second president, Dr. Kenyon. Just to give you a little idea of the difference between the present time and those days, it was the custom at that time for the president to arrange the program. He was the only member of the program committee. Not only did the president preside over the business meetings, which weren't as long as the present ones, he presided over all the scientific papers as well. And we, of course, had only one session at a time, so he could do that. When the president was away or was giving a paper himself, the vice president had to preside. And I got mixed up in one very embarrassing experience. I was presiding over the meeting while Dr. Kenyon was giving a very interesting paper on stammering. And if he got started on stammering, it was very difficult to get him started sometimes. He got about through the introduction, and I found that his time was up. But he was older than I, a very gentlemanly man, my superior, the president. I didn't dare to interrupt the president. And it kept on, and people began to go to sleep. You saw the heads nodding all over the audience there, and they began to sneak out very, very quietly. And this kept on happening by and by. An hour went by, an hour and a quarter. Dr. Kenyon finally looks at this watch, and my gracious, Robbins, why didn't you stop me? That's just a good time to guess we could stop Robbins.
By this time, the association had reached the age of 18, that very difficult period of adolescence. And we could think of no better president to take us through that stormy period of adolescence than Dr. Bring Bringelson.
Sweet things that I have said to these many lovely females prior to the eating of this dinner, would you please indicate that that's off record? It doesn't make too much difference whether or not what I am to say subsequently is recorded. Before I proceed, I'd like to say that even though there's a gleam in my eye, and there was a greater gleam an hour ago, I was serious in what I said to you, Helen, Lucy, Mary, Catherine, and Alice. I was only a graduate when Travis and West started this business of the American Speech Correction Association. And when West was appointed the first president, there wasn't anybody else who wanted the darn job. and it was just pushed over on him. And it was only due to his great inherent humility that he led us through those first stormy years. I just have one regret about today, and that is that this program did not provide an opportunity for about a 30-minute period after this panel on stuttering for the four of us on the platform to continue in what might be called a bull session, so that you folks could get in on it and clarify all the damn lies that we told. I've repeated that to a few of you privately. And it's just a shame that you people can't get in on these lies that we are going to call each other on, the three of us who are remaining. Van Riper sneaked out. But you know, I wish someone would do some research sometime on what the devil an audience does to a speaker, so that his ego gets into the way of telling what he actually believes. It bothers me no end, because I'm just as much of a victim as the rest of them. If I were to make any comments about the four speakers, I think Wendell Johnson maybe had fewer lies to tell than the other three of us. He seems to be just inherently more honest somehow. I thought that during my administration, the highlight which Dr. Moser said we should speak of, the highlight of our administration, was my presidential address. In which I so vociferously agglutinated the polytechnical ectoblasts of homogeneous atestheticism, and then I told you, you can't do it, it's impossible. And may I take this opportunity, without any great embellishment to my character or my peculiar personality traits, of ending this little recorded symposium for Bring Brinkelson, along with the rest of them, of saying something that really belongs to our papas and mamas. And as I say it, I don't want you to feel that I'm throwing any aspersions sarcastically at the American, the Speech Association of America. But what I'm trying to say is that I probably will never have an opportunity to get this off my chest in front of them. So I think that this would be the logical place to do it, because I've got to get it off my chest. And it's in the form of a poem. And it may have some application to you folks, especially when you recall the remark that Dr. Travis made about how stuttering is alleviated as you relax more. And in order to do this with any degree of dignity, I have got to put something around my neck. It used to be called a bandana kerchief. I will now tie it in a knot. It's just too bad that this isn't television, too. And although I think I know what I want to say by heart, I want to keep this manuscript in front of me so I will not forget. This little poem is a parody entitled Relaxation. The shadows of night then falling fast, then through the speech department passed the young student who's skull having yag, and he yells aloud so he can brag, relaxation. Robert West didn't know what this guy's skull mean, men used like this there, dictaphone machine, he keep on saying night and day, I supposed to keeping snakes away, relaxation. Yet Johnson told me this guy been crazy. Then he tell me why. He say, once this guy been gay and happy, then he never say relaxation. And after a while, say, yak, the student meet in fundamental speech class a sweet madame who have a complex and faint. And this guy stood aghast and said, for holy ye, if I ain't for the first time seen relaxation. So now poor student has to pray like many speech majors working without pay. Oh Lord, may I always feel serene, for at last in my speech class I have really seen relaxation.
The next administration was that of Dr. Harry Heltman. Circumstances prevented his being here this evening, and he has sent us his voice in recording. We will now listen, with the help of our engineer, to words from Dr. Harry Heltman.
This is Harry Heltman recording on November 7th, 1950. To the officers and members of the American Speech and Hearing Association, in conference assembled at the Deschler Hotel, Columbus, Ohio, November 10th, and on the occasion of the silver anniversary, at which time you are honoring the past presidents of the organization, and also perhaps to all your successors in future generations who may chance to hear my voice, greetings. It has been suggested that each past president, in his remarks, tell of some incident of human interest that happened during his administration, something humorous, touching, dramatic, or whimsical, that will show that our organization is distinctly a human achievement. As is to be expected of superannuates, I cannot now recall any one isolated event which would hold the interest of such a group as this. If there is one thing more than any other which marks this association as a distinctly human achievement, in my opinion, it lies in a quality rather than in incident or achievement. It is a treasure that was turned up for me during my term and which I still hold precious among my life's experiences. It is the rich fellowship of this craft of men and women of deep understanding, high purpose, banded together for the alleviation of that area of human suffering where those having tongues are of the city of Babel, or having ears, hear not. In this pursuit of new knowledge and better techniques, I have been able to follow only with slow steps and at a distance. But the friendly, encouraging glances from the faces in the vanguard have kept me in the race, and by close observation of your strides, particularly of those of Robert West and Wendell Johnson, I have, I believe, improved my running by keeping your goals ever in sight. Perhaps by staying with you, I have been able to assist a multitude of school children and not a few adult men and women who were beyond your reach and consequently otherwise never would have received any help at all. But ever you will needs think of me as having been a journeyman among you. More than that, I have not aspired to be. My professional self-concept may best be illustrated by an incident that occurred a year or two ago while I was on one of my frequent trips to one of the public schools in this state. I had held a remedial speech clinic on a Friday, and as it was early in May, I decided to stay overnight and go fishing for brook trout on Saturday. I drove some distance up a country road which ran along a small brook that looked promising to a stranger to that region. Stopping my car at a likely spot, I got out and started to put together my tackle, when a lad about 12 came along with a birch rod in his hand. He greeted me with a cheery, "Hi," and then the following dialogue took place. Said he, "Going fishing?" I replied, "Yes, are you?" "Yes, what you using for bait?" "Flies, what are you using?" "Worms." "Are there any trout in this stream?" "Yes, but not so many as in the Wittawake along this road about 2 miles up." What to do? 25 years ago, in the youthful zeal of my professional self-confidence, I might have said, "Boy, you are seriously handicapped by an obnoxious and entirely unnecessary speech defect. In fact, you are in serious need of immediate attention by a speech specialist. Tell your father and mother to bring you up to my clinic at Syracuse University, and we will apply the most advanced methods for correcting the disorder and set you on the path to eventual recovery and happy emotional adjustment." That day, I could only look for some natural approach to the problem without impertinence or trespass. As the morning wore on, we fished at respectful distances from each other, shouting an occasional remark back and forth. When noon came, as I prepared to eat what I had brought, I called to him, "Have you had your lunch?" "No." "Would you like a sandwich?" "No, thank you." "All right, come and get it." He came over and shared the meal with me. My fishing that day was very perfunctory, I assure you. What to do? What to do? During the early afternoon, he came around a bend where he'd been fishing and offered me a large albino sucker which he had caught. It was as unattractive as any fish I'd ever seen, but to him it was a prize, and he was offering it to me. I'm embarrassed now to think that I declined the gift with thanks. But that's another matter. In the mid-afternoon, I decided to make it a day, so I began to get my things together before leaving. He came back to where I was, and I still pondering what to do. What to do? What to do? Then it came to me. Those of you who have known me some time may have heard me say, "If you keep your head open, God will throw something in." Well, I said, "Would you like to learn to do something that you've never done before in your life?" "Yes, yes." "Have you ever played follow the leader?" "Yes." "All right, watch my mouth and do what I do. You know, follow the leader." I showed him the articulation of the L sound and then the enunciation of it. Promptly, he caught on. In 15 minutes, he could say, not fluently, of course, but with careful skill, "Look at a lady, look at a lily." As soon as he could repeat the phrases without my speaking them for him first, I said in parting, "What are you going to say to your mother when you get home?" "I'm going to say, look at a lady, look at a lily." "Are you going to school on Monday?" "Yes." "What are you going to say to your teacher when you get there?" "I'm going to say, look at the lady, look at the lily." "That's right. And when the teacher asks you how it happened, you tell her that a fisherman taught you." And so my colleagues in the profession, at your silver anniversary assembled, a fisherman salute you.
That's not the only discipleship in which the game of fishing has been mentioned. Now, let's go to the next administration, that of Dr. Clarence Simon.
Chairman, I swear I never thought I would be embalmed in a time capsule. But it seems that's what happens to us. On this 25th anniversary, our thoughts naturally turn to time. Because anniversaries mean time, and when you get 25 of them, you have a lot of time. And as I look at the time span, I suddenly realize that few associations, learned, professional, or any other kind, can equal this one in its use of time. We've used time in which to grow, and how we've grown. I think there were 23 charter members, if I read the literature correctly, when this outfit started. George Kopp tells me we have something now over 1,600 members. If you're right nimble with arithmetic, you can find out how many times we have increased our membership over the 25 years. The first PhD in speech correction is sitting with us tonight. By the end of 1949, there were 110 PhDs conferred in speech correction and listed in Mr. Noer's index. How many were conferred in other areas but in speech correction topics, I have no way of knowing. So we've grown. Not only have we grown, but we've paid fast and loose with time itself. What organization do you know of, 25 years old, that can bring three of its first four presidents to the platform and see them bound up and down as agilely as this group has tonight? No wheelchairs, no braces, no grunts even as they go up and down. Bob West here has the pickup and the mileage of a post-war job, not a 1925 Maxwell. Even jet planes don't fly fast enough to get Smiley Blanton here between appointments. And as for that matinee idol that appeared on television this afternoon, how many of you, verdant PhD, have had to ask the university to build five new buildings for you? A 25th anniversary. And where, oh where, is the patriarchal, if somewhat palsied, dignity of founding fathers? And don't you people think that's a young-looking group out there in front, too? You know, for dignified leaders in the profession of speech correction and audiology, there should be more receding hairlines than I see out there in front of me. And on the distaff side, there ought to be more evidences of a need for those routine facials which are the bread and butter of the corner beauty shop. Whatever the old man with the whiskers may be doing to our incomes, there's no question but that we've got the old man with the scythe on standby orders. What is it? Glands? Vitamins? Do we feed them differently now than we did before? This group has two characteristics of childhood which will keep this group young forever. Curiosity. We ask questions. We seek answers. We spend neither time nor energy defending our egos by supporting outworn and questionable speculative propositions. We ask honest questions. We hope for honest answers. I know of no organization with which I am familiar in which the level of honest inquiry, of honest searching for answers, is as high as in this particular group. I know of no group which could display a panel on stuttering, in which the level of scholarship, of friendly rivalry, and of honest affection and respect was at the level that you heard in the panel on stuttering this afternoon. We have another characteristic of childhood in this group, simplicity, because we live simple lives. And it's complexity that brings the wrinkles, the crow's feet, and the barracks bags under the eyes. We live simple lives for the simple reason that this society is dedicated to service. Consistently, we are thinking of the other individual, and we are not carrying with us wherever we go the impedimenta of self. As nearly as any professional group I know anywhere, this group is forgetful of self, and we live simple lives. Don't let these officers up here on the platform fool you. It's 25 years. Officers come and officers go. You'll always have a president around. And maybe he'll be tall, maybe he'll be short, maybe he'll be gray-haired, maybe he'll be red-headed, maybe he won't have any at all. He'll be a president. But the thing that counts is that we as a society keep in perpetuity the childlike virtues of curiosity and simplicity, and that the next 25 years be as the past have been, a chain of living service to other people.
The next administration was by a president who has been nicknamed The Voice, Dr. Herbert Kepbaker.
Hello, everybody. Seems to me that a group of people as nice as you are deserves to have what I would describe as a personal case history of a speech pathologist. My development is somewhat in reverse of the development of most children, adolescents, and adults. Most children, as you know, or at least have read, begin with a real sense of inadequacy, and then as experience grows for them, they become increasingly adequate, and when they get to be real old, are very adequate. I should like, in great confidence, to tell you that my development was in reverse. I want to tell you how it began, and you can draw from it any major life conclusion that you wish. It was in 1926 that I looked in the mouth of the first cleft palate patient I had ever seen. And I made a remarkable deduction. I noticed that the patient had a hole in the roof of his mouth. I went home and decided I would write a paper on cleft palate. That paper, I had a little difficulty in getting it printed. But it came out in mimeograph form in a fraternity paper up in northern Michigan, where they were a little short on things to write about. That was the environment in which Charles Van Riper grew up, and I knew that something great would happen to both of us. As I went along through life, I thought I'd better be something of consequence in the field of speech disorders. I identified myself with this organization and purposed, of course, to continue to write papers. I began at once to look in more mouths and noticed that the hole was still there and that people were doing things about it. So I concluded I'd better write, tell them what I thought about what they were doing about the holes in people's mouths. This I did too. Now my sense of ego expansion, of course, was simply tremendous, and I began to teach and get money for teaching. And I taught in some of the distinguished institutions in this country. And as I grew and continued to expand in almost every direction, I finally concluded that I better begin to tell people these things because I felt them to be of genuine consequence. So I set myself up as a lecturer. And I went about first in small groups, principally service clubs, but gradually I moved out into what I call the professional field. And I did some high-grade lecturing. I told them about speech disorders and what should be done for them, and I thought I was doing it pretty well. As I grew up, I gave lectures to bigger audiences. The first check I ever earned was $25. There are some people in this audience who remember giving me that check. It was in Philadelphia. I walked to the car holding the check in my hand. It was the first money I'd ever earned, saying anything that I said was of consequence. When I got to the car, I sat there looking at the check. Elizabeth Nimoy, who wrote a book, you know, about the consonant sounds, walked up to me and said, "You did a good job," and the check dropped out of my hand. I was so frightened and so ashamed of having taken the money. She picked it up for me and she said, "You really didn't earn this, but it'll help you." I want to tell you that that $25 went to pay for the second installment on our gas stove. I think that's important. I had now arrived at what I thought was complete sense of adequacy. One of the most tremendous things that's ever happened to me in a single lifetime happened to me. I got a letter written by longhand from a distinguished educator in America asking me to lecture to one of the great teachers' institutes of the United States. And I worked hard on that speech. And I prepared it with great care and read a lot of books, and I did pretty well. I want to tell you about the turning point of my professional life. I had arrived now at what I think was complete personal adequacy. I can remember very clearly that huge audience of educators. Here I was, a graduate of a teacher's college and having had some little education beyond that. Here I was telling them how they should do things and do them right. It was a huge audience that extended, as I remember, as far as the eye could reach. I stood there thinking that the time had come when I should make my impact on the world. And I can remember with what order and precision and with what intelligence and with what rhetoric I presented the facts of how children learn to talk, how they can be made to talk better. I looked in the back and I had read in the program that one of the leading educators of the world was going to be a guest. I don't know how I was able to figure out who she was, but she sat somewhat in the back and a little to one side, and I studied her as I talked. She was a somewhat largish person, well developed anteriorly and posteriorly. And then I began to notice that I was doing all right. Every time I would make a point of some reasonable importance, I noticed that she would not, evidently in agreement with me. And that stimulated me. I had never had anybody give me what I would describe an audience personal reaction. And she slid forward in her seat as I talked, and I moved forward in my stance. And we grew together more and more vigorous. Finally, when I arrived at what is ordinarily described, I suppose, in public speaking as the climax of the performance, she almost fell on the floor. But I can vividly recall her nodding approval and the subvocal exclamations of wonder at the tremendous things I was saying and, of course, the fine way I was saying. I thought, now here is a person who is known all over the world and she's going to tell people what a real corker I am. So at the end of the performance, I waited a little, as one does when one makes a speech, you know, for people to come up and tell you how damn good it was. She worked her way through. I remember her working her way through. It was a motivated, urgent, impelling kind of work. She finally got up to the platform, and it took her quite a little while. It seemed the time passed slowly, but she got there. And she walked up to me and put her arms somewhat, as I remember, under my armpits, or my inner armpits. And she pulled me toward her. And she said, I don't ever remember at any time ever having heard a speech as wonderful as that. She said, all the time that I was sitting there, I kept saying to myself, what a beautiful baby you must have been.
President that I have the honor to introduce is Dr. Martin Palmer.
Thank you, Grandpa. Children, trouble with this succession of officers is I have been following Herbert Kebbaker all my life. I'm a Michigan boy, too. He got there first. I followed him there. I followed him into this association. I followed him right straight through, and I'm still following him. And if we do this 25 years from now, I'm going to have to follow him again. So I think I'd better start preparing at this moment for the next time I have to do this. So I was reminded about the passage of time. Well, I guess we all are on occasions like this. Days have a way of passing. The hours have a way of passing. The weeks get into months and then years. And one step removed from the nonverbal reality of this succession of moment on moment is the clock that measures us all. The hours that strike have struck before, and they will always strike again. And in these hours that have already receded away into whatever limbo keeps them on forever, I've looked at the facts. I have measured the data before me. I have carefully integrated them. I have tested my hypotheses. I have discovered that I am the 12th cuckoo in the line. A whole covey of other birds have briefly breached their beaks from their boudoirs and said cuckoo, and had the doors slammed rudely in their face as fast as they got through saying it. And furthermore, I see as I look along this line that I'm not the last one of this brilliant bunch. There's yet another who must pop out, and pop off. And when that's done, there comes yet another, and another, and another, and that's a long and dreary prospect. In another 25 years, going to have to view these birds again, going to have to hear them twice over, twice as many, twice too long. At this convention, we have made some interesting arrangements. We have decided to admit as members of this association the phoneticians, the auditricians, the otologists, the laryngologist, the dentist, the mentist, the baker and his maker, the plumber and his mummer, and even the schoolboy with his toy. If you'll forgive me and respect me, even in this, if in this introduction I have seemed to turn from phonology to ornithology, I'll go again to numerology. 1948, I was supposed to describe its athos and its pathos and its bathos. And all I can say, and I say it feelingly, my brothers and sisters, it had them. It had them big and it had them small and it had them. Now, I'll tell you about it. When a person accepts the presidency of this organization, and it's an organization closest to his heart, he does so, more or less like Agamemnon, the old Greek tragedy, is torn by conflicting emotions. There's a mixture of high pride in his choice by those whom he respects the most, sort of swelling of the soul, a deep and sincere desire to do the best he can to further this cause of helping the silent ones whom we all serve. Back kind of straightens and tries to disguise it, but the chest does bloat out a trifle. And this is all very well, but on second thought, begins to wonder, can he accomplish it? Is he really able? Will it all go well? After all, there were rumors around this association some time ago that even Weston Travis, those supernormals, had a little bit of bucking with their horse when they were in the office. And by George, you know, you're a city boy, and you wonder which end of the horse is up when you're going down. I don't want to satisfy your natural curiosities to answer to these questions. After all, I heard this afternoon that Einstein just sits down and asks questions. And furthermore, we've got a 1951 boy coming on, a candidate for 1952 who must discover for themselves some of these internal truths. All I can say about this is to remind you that it's been reported in this meeting that in April 1948, the minutes of the association show there was a council meeting devoted to the purpose of finding some way of reorganizing this association. I want to take the liberty of also reminding you where the then structure of this organization came from. That I spent a solid year studying 1,451 colleges, universities, and some schools that just called themselves colleges. I got absolute data on all the cases served by all the speech clinics, those reputable and those not so reputable, the space, the equipment, the staffing, so forth, whether they voted the straight Democratic ticket and this, that, the other thing, and ran ranking. File order correlations on all the 15 critical items and so on and so forth. So you can imagine my feeling that the first official action of the association was to do something about that reorganization and get it fixed up. And you can see what they do to presidents in this group. And that wasn't just the start of things. That was the spring crop, so to speak. One of the interesting features about being president of this association is the lecture circuit that develops. Now, if you're a Wendell Johnson, you don't need to be president to get to gallop wildly all over the country. People just naturally enjoy hearing Johnson talk. But when you're president, persons you thought just barely knew you, and what they knew of you was pretty poor, suddenly invite you to give scholarly addresses on the latest result of your last and most brilliant researches. So there I was on an eastern campus. The day was done. It was summertime. I just finished the dullest series of 4 hours of lecture that were ever perpetrated on an unsuspecting batch of school teachers in for summer session. This, coupled with the last bucking of the Bronco I had engaged to ride in this year, had finally convinced me I was not of the line of the great, and that for the good of the association, I'd better plead off or beg off or even more easily just jumping the flowing river of time, when up came number 1947 to see me. He enlightened me. He told me stories of his administration that made my one hair stand right up on end. I resolved to be a braver and better man, and we survived. I finished the term, and the scars don't seem to show. Enough of this. This association is really a great thing. It's a thing of dynamic force. It's a thing that has right in it. It has moral values. It has ethical values. It has intellectual truth in it. The devotion of its members to humanity has been demonstrated over and over again. Any organism living in this sort of truth must live and grow. And if it seems to stutter here and there, it's only because of a quarter-second delayed feedback, which is purely temporary. And stutters are amply normal most of the time. But seriously, this union in a common cause is as great for us as those we serve. I respect you birds up ahead of the line. I admire you birds down at the foot of the line. And I pity you birds that are yet to come.
The next president liked the job of being president so well, that he got the job of being president of a university. Our next president is President Dwight W. Morris.
I'm sorry you counted them, Palmer, because that makes me number 13. I believe you called your administration the birth of the association. Travis's was referred to as the completion of infancy period. President Robbins was in his age of puberty, I mean the association. And I feel that in rather a real sense, it was my pleasure, and that has been shared by the president of this year, to sit in on the completion of adolescence in this association and watch it really enter into adulthood. We are seeing now a process of fruition of the growth process, a maturation of the delineated elements of interest in the personnel of this association in such a way as to bring together in a workable plan the interests of speech correction, hearing, and inquiries into basic phonetics in such a way as to allow a fruitful living together while at the same time providing the channel of independent growth and development which must be provided at a certain step in the fractionation and the development of human knowledge and function. And it is truly gratifying to see this group as an association grow into professional adulthood, and as Travis so well put it the other day, establish the reason for being a discipline. It's been my pleasure to be a member of this association for just 14 years. Thinking of that reminded me of a sequence of experiences I've had during this past summer. Our oldest boy will be 14 one of these days. During this past summer, I've had this kind of interesting experience. To be sitting in a room over in the corner of the house and hear a voice out in the house somewhere, then go out a few minutes later to say, "Who was here a while ago?" To be told that was our oldest son. The change of voice was so complete, so unexpected, because of the fact that, as you all know, you sort of forget the passage of the years, that it came as a bit of a shock to realize that it wasn't a stranger in the house, and a bit of an additional shock to realize that it was a stranger in the house. And our association is somewhat like that. I think probably those on the platform may share with me the feeling, a bit of surprise, having gone along from year to year, from day to day, much as we do growing up and watching people grow up, coming to a period of time such as tonight when we stop and look at ourselves in cross-section to be a bit amazed at what we see and a bit surprised at the things at which we look. Because of cross-sectioning in time, one just must reminisce a bit. You've been reminisced at quite a little here. We're going to do a little more of it. As I look down the sides of this table, I cannot help but say personally what I imagine every person in this room feels. That there is a a sense of debt, a sense of personal and professional obligation binding me to every person at this table. I suspect we all feel that in some measure. Whatever we may be as individuals or as a group, we are also members of a social matrix which binds us to our fellows. I cannot but mention a few things about some of these dear people at the table. I recall one of the most important highlights of my early attendance at the convention of this association. I think it was the second one. It was a thrill I carried with me through the rest of the convention, and oh, for days thereafter. There wasn't much business in the hotel at the moment on the elevators when I stepped on the elevator. And on that elevator, the only other passenger was Robert West. It's the closest I'd been to him. I'd seen him sort of around the meeting. I'd watched him going from here to there, but there I was on that elevator with him all by myself, and he spoke to me. I was grateful. It was years later, at least three or four, before I discovered the humane, lovable, deep-seated, sincere social interest of this man, Robert West. But I still remember that highlight, that second year at the association. And Bob, I'm so glad you spoke to me. I remember one of my early experiences with Lee Travis. He always had a way of building up a man's ego. He always had a way of making you feel important. I remember one of his first comments to me. It was the year after he was president. Goldstein was president. I remember Travis passed me in the hall, didn't look at me, started on down the hall. All at once he turned and stopped and called back to me and said, "Hey," your name. I went back to him and he sort of looked out the window and started to say something, and then he caught himself, thought better of it. Finally decided to go through with it. He said, "Goldstein's having trouble filling up the program. I told him, put you on." That was the way I got on the first program. I don't know if you remember that or not. It was the most gratifying experience. And then I remember the very sweet and pleasant thing you did, Madam President. The things which you do so well and have always done to help a person, to open an opportunity for them. It was really a more important thing than you realize when you asked me to help arrange that program with you out at Detroit. I mention that because I know that in her experience in this association, Dr. Hawk has on many occasions exhibited a spirit of reaching out to help bring into the active function, not only in the affairs of the association, but in professional activity, young people whose interest is high, whose enthusiasm is strong, but whose knowledge of knowing what to do next is very, very slight. I remember Robbins. Down at Penn State, do you remember? You folks elected me secretary that year. I mentioned that in order to tell what I remember about you on that occasion. After the meeting was all over, after it was all finished, I remember out in the vestibule outside the meeting hall, Professor Robbins met me and congratulated me, and he said, "Well, now you'll want to get right on in this association. You'll want to learn the duties of this office. The first thing for you to do to help you get onto it is write up the minutes of this meeting that's just finished." Remember that?
I do.
And then I remember a few years later when President Robbins became president. That was back in the days of the first Young Turk movement. You know, at a certain time in any organization, you have Young Turk movement. That's the first Young Turk movement. I remember President Robbins came in as president, and some of us sort of talked the thing over for a while, you know, and we said, my goodness, he's been around a long time. I bet he's just going to run this meeting like an old fogey. I'll bet we just sit in these meetings till all hours of the night and never get out. We'll just never get anything done. Those of you who were there will remember that before that first night was finished, we had nicknamed Robbins Engineer because he was railroading everything through so fast. We got all our business done by 9 o'clock and had nothing else to do. And then I remember Bringles. I remember him most clearly for his wife, Minda. A number of years ago, Wendell Johnson and I took a trip up to Minneapolis. It was a matter of exchanging some documents in relation to journals and some treasures, materials and records. They went in one little box at that time, I remember. But on that occasion, that trip to Minneapolis, went out to Bringleson's lovely home, skidded out over the ice. Horrible climate up there. Got to his house, and his wife, Minda, met me. First time I'd met her. She showed me up to my room. Lovely room. And I stood there looking at one of the twin beds. And walked over to it, and I wanted to be helpful, and I said, perhaps you want to take this pillow off the bed so I won't mess it up. I always carry my own pillow with me. She turned around and looked at me, and this is why I remember Minda instead of Ray. She said, do you still take your bottle too? That night, too, that I learned something about Swedes and stutterers when you get them together. We met around the fireplace that night and started to talk. Got along about 11 o'clock, I suppose about that now. I began to get sleepy, tired of animated, interesting conversation. We had the pleasure of sitting there listening to an enormous number of high-level abstractions, presented in a very abstract way. Long about midnight, 1 o'clock somewhere along there, I thought, well, maybe I can sort of move this process along just a little bit. I excused myself and went to bed. Went upstairs, had a bath and pajamas, started bed, and I sort of listened for cessation of activity downstairs. Seemed to be only accelerating. I thought, well, I can't allow this. I can't just give up on this thing. So I put on robes and some slippers and went back down, sit it out. Well, presently, some hours later, somebody dropped in. Spencer Brown, I think. Somebody with him, I think his wife. Dropped in, and they sat there around 2:30 in the morning. They got worn out. Well, along about 3 o'clock in the morning, the abstractions began to get of just a little less high order level. Conversation began to get a bit interesting. moved along in an animated kind of way. And just to show you how things work out up in Minneapolis on a cold winter night when you get Bringleson and Johnson together, along about 8 o'clock, Minda said, why don't we have something to eat? And we did. We had breakfast. And Bring said, well, I'll take you to the train. They took me to the train, and I left town. I have that memory of our President Bringleson and our President Johnson, and I learned a very great deal that night. I thank you very much. I remember another little experience I had at this association. It was many and many a year ago. It was down on that same island of Manhattan. There was a meeting down there going on. It was one of those long rooms that always filled up and you couldn't get inside, and then just back was a little vestibule, and you sat back out in the vestibule. You could sort of talk and tune in and listen, alternately, speaker. I was sitting back there in that vestibule, way back in the window, listening to one of these old patriarchal fathers of this association carry forth in that meeting in there, and there was a young squirt sitting there on the window ledge beside me. He's here tonight, too. He was sort of fidgety. He started squirming on that window ledge, and then occasionally he'd get up and he'd walk back and forth across that vestibule, and he'd wring his hands. I couldn't figure out what was wrong with him. He was obviously pent up about something, and finally he said, "I wish I could get on the floor." I said, "Get on what floor?" "Get on the floor inside there." I said, "What for?" "I wish I could get on the floor," he said, "and tell that guy how wrong he is." He didn't get on the floor in that convention, but he's been on it plenty since. And next year, he's going to be standing up here as president of this association. His name is Max Steger. And I wonder if he remembers that little incident. I mention it for this reason: to wish with you that this association may continue to grow and develop. May the young squirts progress steadily to leadership. May their enthusiasm never be stultified. May their intellectual curiosity grow unabated. If we can achieve that very simple human objective during the next 25 years of this association, well, may we have a 50th anniversary, or we will have something worthy for which to have an anniversary.
Now we come to the president that brings us to the end of our 25th year, Dr. Wendell Johnson.
I want mainly to convey a kind of feeling. I'm going to be interested in how it somehow manages to get out of me. I feel that all my life I have been somehow surrounded by kindness. It started out with a teacher I had when I went to school, first grade. She was a woman to whom it simply seemed to come naturally to love children. And in her zeal to be good to me and to see that I became all that I ought to become, she told my parents that I was stuttering and that they ought to do something about it. Now, she did this because she loved me. They forgot to ask her what she meant, so they took me to the doctor. I must emphasize that old Doc Hettinger was one of the world's noble characters. He died at the age of 98 from eating too much boiled cabbage. And After his death, the town in which he had lived deteriorated. He had been the moral bulwark of it. He was a very loving sort of man. He also had some kind of understanding, even though he didn't have a medical understanding of my stuttering. He had an understanding of the real reason why we had come. So he knew that he ought to do something. So he gave me pills. I want to show you what a very understanding and a very kindly man he was, because by telling you that he flavored those pills with peppermint. You see, my teacher and the doctor had love. They had a little understanding, but not too much. Well, the years went on, and then I got to Iowa, and I met Lee Travis. I met Dean Carly Seashore and George Stoddard and Edward Mabee, and I was stuttering awfully badly. I don't know why it was they encouraged me. I really don't yet, but they did. And Lee spent a year, an hour a day with me. He listened to me an hour a day for a year. Then he began to use me for a guinea pig. Just in a very large variety of attempts to help me. He was a scientist, and he had a love that had about it a great deal more understanding. The man in the laboratory is the one who has really helped me. The others wanted to, but they didn't always know how. You see, out of all this, what I gather is that understanding without love, as we all know, can be very dangerous. It can have effects that are alarming. And love without understanding can be disappointing at the very best. I want to wish to the listeners who will be hearing this after the passage of another 25 years that in those years our love will gain more understanding, and our understanding might gain more love.
That's almost a benediction. Now, I'm sure that you realize the tremendous pride I have in what I have to say next. That the moment we finish this program, we have finished 25 years, and we're beginning again on another 25 years. And I wish to Max Steer and his successors who will follow him the greatest of success.